Welcome to Inside the Coaching Mind, conversations on leadership, coaching, and team building. Your host, Terry Pettit, led the University of Nebraska volleyball team from 1977 to 1999 and coached the Cornhuskers to their first national championship in 1995. Today, Coach Pettit mentors fellow coaches, authors books, and presents to corporations and businesses on leadership and team building. Now, without further ado, here's your host, Coach Terry Pettit.
Hello, I'm Terry Pettit, the host of Inside the Coaching Mind, and I'm here with our producer, Dave Pulaski, and our special guest, Emily Eamon, who is a play-by-play analyst for the Big Ten and ESPN networks. She's also a former defensive specialist for Northwestern Volleyball and a former multi-sport athlete from Bloomington, Indiana. Emily, if we were meeting to talk about volleyball in Bloomington, where would we meet?
Ooh, probably one of my favorite coffee places, Soma. I don't know if you've ever heard of it, but it's an amazing coffee place. I think they have the best coffee in the country. I'm a big Starbucks girl, but Soma is one of my favorite places for sure.
So we'd be hanging out there. And the first question that I'm going to ask you is the question I would ask you there. You know, you were a multi-sport athlete in high school in Bloomington, and I read it said, instead of track and field, it said field. So what was the event in field that you did?
So it was funny. I was a very, very big into track. Even from an early age, I started in fourth grade, and my main events as I got into high school and a little more specialized were high jump, long jump, and hurdles. So those are kind of where the field plays in. You know, they'd throw me in a 4x1 or a 4x4 if, you know, someone got hurt or they needed me. But my thing was jumping. You know, I wanted to jump out of the gym. That was the number one thing that I kind of focused on in terms of track. And of course that, you know, translated to volleyball really well.
And how about heptathlon? Did that evolve?
It's funny you ask. I remember in high school, my coach, I ended up working with an individual coach because I really wanted to get my jump up and I wanted to be one of the best long jumpers in the state, which I didn't get there. But yes, he kept pushing it really hard. He thought I would have been great at it. It was just, you know, playing volleyball, that was my number one love. And you're playing essentially year round with a full club schedule. And I was playing at a club up in Indianapolis. So it was about an hour, depending on traffic, maybe hour and a half drive both ways, you know, 3-4 times a week. So I always wanted to do a heptathlon, but it was something I didn't have time for.
Now you choose to go to Northwestern, mm-hmm. which is a great journalism school. Why not go to IU? Why not go to Bloomington, yeah. Sherry Dunbar and play?
Yeah. So it's interesting for me. I've known since I was 10 years old that I wanted to be a broadcaster. So even looking at all the colleges I was looking at, the one thing I looked at was, did they have a good journalism school? And so I was looking at schools like Northwestern, Cornell, Mizzou, Syracuse. Those were my schools that I wanted to go to. And then I kind of figured out if I had a volleyball connection there. So Northwestern actually was always my dream school. My mom's from around Chicago. So I grew up coming to Chicago, you know, multiple times a year. It's my favorite city in the world. So Northwestern was always a dream school. And I think being from Bloomington, you know, I just had such a big Big Ten background. My uncle was a basketball coach at IU, and I was so ingrained in sports and especially Big Ten sports that I wanted to stay in the Big Ten. So Northwestern ended up working out. My high school coach happened to know the coach I was recruited by, which is Keeler Chan, who ended up leaving actually before my freshman year and went to Stanford. But Shane Davis came in and it ended up working out. But yeah, my number one focus was going to a good journalism school, because again, I knew from a very young age what I wanted to do.
Just an asterisk here. Did you know, when I started coaching at Nebraska in the, they were covered wagons then, but Northwestern was probably the best Big Ten volleyball team. Jerry Angle, teammate of mine in Chicago, we both played on the same club team. He was on the A team. I was on the B or C team. But Northwestern was, for 2 or 3 years there, far and away the best Big Ten team. And then it transitioned into Purdue, and they were very strong. And then Illinois had a great run with Mike Hebert. And then Penn State came in And now we've seen the evolution of with Nebraska joining the conference and Wisconsin. But Northwestern really had a jump on other schools at the time. Were you aware of that?
You know, I'm aware of it now, but it's funny, when I played there, I had no idea. You know, we would have alumni night and have these players come in that they would say we're all Americans or whatever. And I'm thinking, like, we haven't had an all American since I've been alive. Like, that was never a thing. But now I think that I'm in this role and understanding just more so the history of the Big Ten and history of these schools. It was something I remember, I think last year, looking into, and I was like, oh my God, like we used to be a really good team. And then of course, now you have, you know, so many other schools in the Big Ten that are just so fantastic. It's hard to kind of build up a program back to where it once was decades ago.
Yeah. Well, so when I think of journalism, when I went to college, I wanted to be a journalist. But I thought of print journalism. I mean, it was the primary talent or skill was writing. How much does writing come into play into what you do?
So much. And that was something I learned at Northwestern, actually, because when I committed to Northwestern, the journalism school, actually, the program was set up in terms of tracks. So you had your newspaper track, broadcasting, magazine. It was very specialized. And then when I got to Northwestern, they actually switched it. So they got rid of all the tracks and they wanted you to be a well-rounded journalist. So what that meant was a lot of writing, and writing was definitely not my strong suit going in. Again, I knew I wanted to be a broadcaster from when I was pretty young. So I never put too much stock in terms of writing, and I wasn't bad, but I just didn't think I was a great writer. So I remember being in these early classes with, you know, some of the best writers in the country at our age, with people that are just absolutely elite doing internships at, you know, the New York Times and all these crazy places, and feeling like I was so behind. But what I realized was, one, I was better than I thought at it. And I realized how much it plays into broadcasting and doing commentary of any kind, whether that's, you know, a lot of the stuff I do for Big Ten Network right now is from the digital front as well. So a lot of those pieces aren't exactly written out, but, you know, it definitely helps when I can sort of script things out, and it helps me become a better broadcaster when you're a better writer. You know how to present information in a way that maybe other people broadcasting might not be able to do. So yeah, I realized once I got to college that writing was so, so important. And I actually, thinking back, I'm really grateful that Northwestern wanted us to be well-rounded rather than just focusing on our specific trade that we wanted to do.
Right. Where did you intern? Did you intern at places that helped you transition or gave you opportunities in broadcasting?
Yeah. So the only time, you know, playing sports, the only time we could really do internships was during the summer. And because Northwestern was on the quarter system, we didn't finish school until the second week of June. And then, you know, we start preseason the first week of August. So I really had a 6-week period where I could get in internships in there. But yeah, I was lucky to have a few. So after my sophomore year, I was a digital content intern at the Chicago Fire Soccer Club. So I was doing content creation, a lot of video editing, nothing on camera, but it was really honing in on, you know, how to edit, how to run a social media page. And this was kind of when social media really started booming. It was, you know, the networks and teams were trying to figure out how to even curate their pages and figure out what worked best. And so it was really cool being kind of at the start of that for a professional soccer team was really cool. And I had absolutely no soccer background, so I was playing catch up all the time. The summer after that, so summer before my senior year, I interned at Big Ten Network in their digital department that at the time was called New Media, because again, you know, digital was so new. I think the team was only like 6 people big, and now of course, you know, it's like 30 people. But yeah, I interned there, which was again a lot of video editing, nothing really on camera, just getting good at the production side of things, because I kind of took the route of, if I can understand the back end of a lot of how production and TV works, then I'll be better in front of the camera. And I think it was really helpful, you know, learning how to edit my own videos and watching broadcasters and maybe people on social media present information and kind of watching them and seeing maybe what they do well and how I might improve it. And then my senior year, the end of our journalism program was a thing they called JR. So journalism residency, where we had to do a quarter long residency at a network or a print or wherever we wanted to go. So I did one for a national network called Newsy. And Newsy is essentially a 24-hour cable news network that is very much set on presenting facts and presenting news in a way that's unbiased. And I think they do a really good job of that. So I did a lot there. I was a video editor. I did a little bit of stuff on camera. I wrote a lot of scripts for them, for the anchors for that night. And I think that was the first job I had that was not sports centered at all. I mean, I was mainly doing politics for a very long time, and I ended up staying on with them. Took a little break once I graduated and then got a part-time job with them while I was still early on in my career. So yes, I was able to do a few, but you know, of course, with playing a college sport, it was a little more restrictive than I would have liked.
Did you ever go to intramural matches or turn off the sound on TV and pretend like you were doing color or play-by-play?
So it's funny. I had always heard of people doing that. And for me, I never wanted to be a volleyball analyst. Like, I didn't grow up being like, I want to do volleyball commentary. I kind of ended up in this role and I am so beyond thankful for it. But no, growing up, I mean, the women I saw on TV were either sideline reporters or studio hosts. So I didn't grow up listening to, one, a lot of volleyball because there wasn't that much to watch, but two, even just women on air doing commentary or even, you know, doing play-by-play. I grew up watching women that were sideline reporters and hosts. So I never wanted to do commentary because I didn't think that was a job that even existed. So I didn't do that, but I would practice like interviewing skills. So, you know, I'd watch a game and then think of two or three questions that like I would want to ask a coach after, you know, whatever NFL game I just watched was on. That was kind of the only thing I did sort of related to that.
Mm-hmm. So you arrive at Northwestern. Keeler is no longer there. Mm-hmm. And Keeler, I thought, was a very good coach.
Yeah.
And Shane Davis comes in and you assume a role. I looked up your stats and so forth through 4 years. It was kind of up and down. Sometimes you played a lot. Sometimes 1 year.
Yeah.
1 year you and I played about the same.
None.
Wow.
Yeah. But I mean, it was, I was a walk-on in that team. I expected to ride the bench for 4 years. I never expected to play a game, to be honest. I ended up playing a little bit freshman year just because we had so many injuries, and senior year was the same kind of thing. I ended up starting and playing a ton my senior year, but that was, again, really just due to a lot of injuries that we had in our team. I don't think I was doing anything special. It just kind of happened that way. But no, my role at Northwestern, I was the bench captain. We created a lot of cheers on the sidelines. I still think we had 100% the best bench in the Big Ten. And even now, doing a lot of games broadcasting wise, I look at the bench a lot to see what they're doing. And I still think that we had the best bench in the Big Ten. And I don't even think it was comparable, but that was my role. You know, I assumed that from a really early on in my career. And I knew that if that was going to be my role of not playing, then I was going to be the loudest in the gym. I was going to work really hard in the weight room and try to be the strongest on the team, fastest on the team. Any way that I could kind of help push my teammates if I couldn't do it on the court.
Well, there are not very many coaches. And I would even across the board that have been great Olympic players for several reasons. One, they sometimes spend their first 14 years going overseas while other people are spending 14 years coaching. Mm-hmm. But I think there's another reason. I think there's a real advantage in being on a team and not playing if you have the right mentality.
Mm-hmm.
I saw a game the other day with a team that I watch frequently, and a middle blocker got in the match who had not played hardly at all in 4 years. She goes in and is tremendous, reading what is about to happen.
Yeah.
And so she may not have had the same vertical jump as the starter or the size, but during those 4 years, she was learning an awful lot about the game.
Yeah.
I don't know how many athletes have the mindset to be willing to put in that time today without playing time. What's your thought on that?
No, I completely agree. And when that happens, I think when a lot of people get pulled from the bench, maybe into a game, if someone's struggling or maybe even if someone gets injured, I feel like a lot of times you see that player do really well. And I think it's mainly because during, you know, during practice that week, they have to know the scouting report better than anyone, because a lot of times they're having to act as those players. So you have, you know, a middle, yes, let's say a middle on a team that has to go in. She's been acting as the other team's middle all week in practice. So she knows them like the back of their hand at that point. She knows their hitter tendencies. She knows what they're going to do, you know, in system, out of system, so be it. I agree. I think it takes a different mindset coming into a program where, at the end of the day, most collegiate athletes are stepping into a program and they were the best on their high school team. You know, they might've been the best in the state, but that doesn't guarantee you playing time. You could be Gatorade player of the year in whatever state you're in, but that doesn't mean that you're going to be a starter freshman year. That doesn't mean you're even going to really play. So I think understanding that going into college and not being the best on your team right away, because that rarely ever happens, is something that's really hard to grasp. And then you go years down the line and let's say you're a senior and you haven't played then. I think it's just being of the mindset of just at the end of the day, being a team player. You know, you want to make your team better, whether that means you're going to be the best on the scout team, whether that means you're going to push everyone as hard as you can in sprints. If that means you're going to cheer everyone on and be the loudest in the gym, then that's what you got to do. But it definitely is it's such a hard mind switch from when you come in freshman year, because you have a big ego check from high school.
So this is what you mean by benchmosphere?
Benchmosphere, yeah. I'm telling you, we had the best benchmosphere. I thought, I knew that was my role. I also was such a, you know, high energy player, whether I was on the court or whether I wasn't. I was, you know, I lost my voice every game. I remember in senior year, it was one of the first games I actually started, played the whole game. And I remember talking to Coach Davis after the game and I was like, Coach, like, I'm not going to lie, I get more tired on the bench than I do in the game. Like I'm cheering my butt off and it's exhausting. Whereas in the game, I feel like, you know, I'm working hard, but it's not the same kind of thing. So, yeah, for me, it was a big thing to try to, you know, have the most loud and exciting and, intuit bench in the country, in the Big Ten.
Emily, I don't know how many times I've seen inexperienced coaches have success based on energy alone.
Yeah.
You know, if you can come in to work every day and bring energy, you've got a very good chance of surviving till you learn the skills that you need in a profession. Mm-hmm. Wednesday night, two nights from tonight, Nebraska and Wisconsin play, and you're going to be doing the color, and Anne-Marie Anderson's going to be doing the play-by-play. Mm-hmm. What type of preparation do you go through for that match?
Yeah, so I'm lucky for this match in that I've had Nebraska and Wisconsin so many times this year already. So I feel like for these teams, I know them like the back of my hand. You know, I mean, we have, I do the same preparation essentially for each game, but it gets less and less the more I have teams, which is nice. But I will say for a typical game, a lot goes into it. I have a chart for each team that I make with all the rosters and spots for, I do hitter, setter, serving tendencies, you know, what a hitter or setter likes to do in system, out of system, where they like to hit. I throw stats in there, trends, if they've had, you know, six, like for example, Becca Alec has had her last six matches, she's been hitting over 385. You know, that's a trend I like to know headed into a match of, okay, they're getting better every game. Or if someone's not playing as well every game, for example, I had Purdue last week and Eva Hudson, her numbers have kind of started to fluctuate a lot more as the Big Ten season has gone on. So I focused a lot on trends. And then I have a team notes page. So a lot of that is, you know, where they rank in the Big Ten in terms of blocking or hitting percentage or all of those different things. We have coaches calls with each head coach before the game. So usually 1 to 2 days before, we'll have about a half hour call and just ask them a lot of different things. You know, depending on what happened the week before, biggest takeaways, you know, what you feel like your biggest strength is right now. For this matchup specifically, you know, I talked to both head coaches about, you know, to you, is this a rematch of the national championship? And it was interesting talking to both coaches because they really don't feel like it is, because there's been so much turnover on both teams. And they're completely different teams than they were last season with the amount of, you know, stars that both of them lost. But Along with that, I also go back and watch each match from the weekend before. So the last match that they played, if it's a matchup that's already happened this year, I'll go back and watch the first time they met. For example, I have Minnesota and Wisconsin on Saturday. So I'll go back and watch the game where Minnesota had swept them a few weeks ago and try to, you know, see what worked for each team, what didn't work. And then I do a lot of like scouting. So I go on Volumetrics, which is a system that you can essentially just watch, like click through a hitter hitting every single ball or to get tendencies really easily. I do a lot of scouting on Volumetrics and looking up those tendencies and what players are doing in what situations. So that's kind of my game prep. And then, you know, it's calls with your play-by-play and producer to go over big storylines for the games that you definitely want to hit on, maybe graphic ideas. I'm really big into stats. So I kind of like finding statistical trends or things that I find, you know, tell a good story through statistics. So I'll kind of do some deep dives there as well.
Well, give me an unusual stat that most people wouldn't think of that maybe reveals something.
So yeah, actually this one specifically for this game, this is because I have access to Volumetrics. It makes it really helpful, but the difference for both these teams running a 6-2, they have two different setters. So I've been really interested in what the team hits off of each setter for each team. So for example, for Nebraska, between Nicklin Hames and Ani Evans, it's very even. Nicklin, they hit 305 off of, and Ani, they hit about 310. So they're very, very equal, where Wisconsin, these numbers aren't completely up to date because they haven't updated from Michigan the other night. But for MJ Hamill and Izzy Ashburn, it's a bigger drop off. So Izzy Ashburn right now, they're hitting about over 300 for her. And then for MJ Hamill, it's kind of mid to low 200s. So there's a really big drop off in terms of the efficiency that the team is hitting off of both setters. And, you know, that really stat only works in a 6-2, but for this matchup specifically, I think it's fun to look at in terms of what hitters are doing what with their given setter.
It sure is. And I don't want to get too technical here, but you said Nebraska is hitting over 300 on both setters, mm-hmm. but the team's hitting 270, which means when the libero sets, it's considerably less than that. And it was maybe 5 years ago, teams were hitting at about zero when the setter didn't set the ball. That has changed considerably. Yeah. Why do you think that is? Why are teams so much better when the libero's taking the ball now than maybe 5-10 years ago?
Yeah, I think part of it for Nebraska specifically, I mean, I think Lexi Rodriguez is one of the best out of system setters that there is. I mean, she has amazing hands. She also puts it in a good spot. But I mean, for me, it seems, at least from talking to coaches, and a lot of them are so focused on their out of system game, I think maybe it's become a bigger focus in the gym for liberos and non-setters to put up a really good ball. And it depends on the team that's coaching. I mean, some teams right now are really focused on a tighter out of system set, which I still think is questionable, but you know, the classic 5 feet off, 5 feet in, I think Nebraska does such an incredible job. Lexi Rodriguez can put the ball up pretty much. I feel like she can thread the needle on almost all of her out of system sets or passes. And I think that's why that team specifically is doing awesome, because they run a 6-2. The ball is going to get on the setter so often. And so Rodriguez has to be great out of system. And I think that's one of the reasons why they're having success, is because the team is really good hitting off of her out of system.
Is that the best way to handle that? You know, years ago, we've seen that evolve. For a long time, we had the right side player was called a technique player. The setter would dig the ball to the right side player, who had setting skills, and she could run a slide to the middle or set the left front.
Yeah.
Then for a while, they dug the ball to the middle blockers, who would either set forward or set backward. Now every team kind of copies what everybody else is doing, and the libero's stepping up and setting almost always from angle.
Yeah.
But there are some teams, Washington several years ago ran the libero at a middle back, and the angles for her taking the ball with her hands were even better. I'd like to see a little bit more creativity in that position. The other thing I'd like to see, when the setter digs the ball, I'd love to see the libero be able to use her hands.
Yeah.
To me, no other sport requires you to dumb down the fundamental. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like, well, you're the small forward, so you can't bounce pass it to LeBron James. You've got to bump it off your chest. But at any rate, how much does what you do change depending on the color person you're working with?
Yeah, different for the play-by-play. So it's interesting. I think just being in this job and only having done it for about 2 years now, I mean, I've had so many different play-by-play people. And now this year specifically doing games for ESPN, like I've had different play-by-play people every time. Of course, you build up a rapport with the ones that you've had a lot. So for example, Connor Onion, he's a play-by-play person at Big Ten Network. And I have done dozens of games with him. He's kind of the person I'm with the most. And I feel like you gain a certain comfortability with someone that you've been with a lot. You gain, you know, just fun banter back and forth. You know each other better. Communication wise, it makes it easier of he knows exactly probably when I'm going to come in and get out of a certain point. And I know that about him as well. It's a lot of times when a color person is working with a new play-by-play, they can step on each other's toes a lot, just from the standpoint of you're still learning how they're calling the game and they're learning how you're calling the game, and just the dance of both of us working together is of course questionable in the beginning because it's never happened. So I think just having good communication early on in terms of, you know, like I always tell them, I never want to talk over you. So if you're going to ask me a question, please don't ask me right before the serve, because I want to let you call the match. It's just a lot of communication before the game starts in terms of how you kind of want to handle those things. But I mean, it definitely makes it difficult when you're working with someone new every night or, you know, every few nights, but you know, it's also part of the game right now, learning how to adapt, with a new team that you're on essentially.
Well, does the producer make those decisions, or is it just you and the play-by-play that makes the decision about how you're going to handle who does what?
Yeah, I mean, our producers don't have a ton of, at least in my experience, they don't have a ton of hold in terms of, you know, when we're coming in and when we're not. There's kind of set standards, I guess. So the play-by-play typically will always welcome you back from break or send it to break. And in terms of, you know, roles and all that, you know, play-by-play sets up the analyst on most things, but not a lot of it comes from the producer. You know, I mean, they really are just in our ear telling us like when a replay is coming, how long we have until break. If they have a cool graphic that they want to get in, they'll alert you before then. But in terms of, you know, content and flow of the game, it's more so a conversation between the color and the play-by-play.
More women are playing high school volleyball than any other team sport.
Yeah.
So why are we still telling people that it's 15 points in the fifth set?
Look, I think for volleyball right now, I've always learned and been under the assumption that anyone listening to a game, 50% of my audience is probably an expert and 50% has never watched a sport before. So you want to have the balance of being able to teach the game to people that have no idea what you're talking about. And then you have the balance of people that actually do understand the X's and O's and being more technical with it. But I mean, we're at a point right now with volleyball where it's on TV more than ever. The viewership numbers are so high and we're welcoming in a lot of new viewers. So you have to balance that with teaching the game, you know, explaining what an out of system set is and explaining the rules, the in and out calls. You have to kind of balance that along with, of course, pointing out the X's and O's of the game.
On my Facebook page, somebody said, would you ask Emily why the Big Ten doesn't have the cameras that they have internationally? So
we're praying for them every day.
So the challenges, you know, it's like hell. It's like you're chained up against the wall and hearing two people talk about fingers for 2 minutes.
It's as painful to talk through it as I'm sure it is to listen. I mean, there's certain challenges where I'm like, just go to commercial. Like, who cares at this point? I don't know. I mean, I do understand that, you know, at the end of the day, those cameras and the capabilities are really expensive. For me, the thing that I would like to see improved is just communication between refs to our broadcasters and you know, whether that's to a producer. I mean, we have someone sitting there that's supposed to get the information and relay it to us. But sometimes we don't even know what we're looking at. We don't know what the challenge is. And you know, you do your best to guess about it, but at the end of the day, that's a disservice to the viewers. And, you know, you're just guessing half the time. So yes, better cameras would definitely shore that up. I think when you have a 5-minute break in a game to see if there is a finger bent backwards, it's like the most painful thing. And if I'm a viewer, I'm probably leaving. I don't want to stay during that. But for me, it's like, I just want the communication piece of it. Like, I want to be able to know exactly what they're looking at what point in the point they're looking at it. Cause I think it would smooth up a lot of that time.
Have you had some matches for one reason or another that either you or the play-by-play person has had to be remote? They weren't in the arena.
Yeah. A lot of times, actually. I think back to last year, and yes, I mean, COVID was still happening. And so they were hesitant about putting us, you know, on planes and traveling to all these places. So for example, last year I had 18 games for Big Ten Network, and only 5 of them were on site. So a vast majority of my games were calling from a studio in Chicago, and it really changes the way you call a game. It's really hard to tell exactly what's going on, because really the only feed we're seeing for the most part is the one that you see on TV. So you can't look at the benches. You can't look at what the coach is doing, how they're reacting.
There's no extra cameras.
There are, but the way that it's set up, I mean, we have one big monitor that shows the game, and then you have a lot of small little cameras that you can see, but I mean, it's a lot harder than when you're actually physically there to be able to look at what you want and when you want to look at it. But this year it has been so great. They're sending us to a lot more games. So I have 26 games this year, and I think 21 of them are on site. So it's a complete reversal of last year. It's been just so much better to be on site and get FaceTime with coaches and players. I mean, it makes such a big difference in just relationship building and building the trust with the coaches. That's, you know, one thing I've really tried to do over the last 2 years is really build up that trust, be comfortable with them, have them be comfortable with me. And being on site is so helpful for that.
Right. Well, we've got so many younger, really strong female coaches. I want to talk about 2 or 3 of those. And if you could give me some insight, or give us some insight into what you think their brand is, what you think they do really well. Jen Flynn Oldenburg, the head coach at Ohio State. Why is she so good? Why are they so good?
Yeah, she is so easy to root for. I think she is a very genuine person. And by that, I mean, she is just a really great person. She's very nice. She relates to her players so well, I think, because of course she's been there. She's still kind of young enough to feel like she can relate to them, but I think she does a great job balancing, you know, criticism and coaching with also telling them what they're doing right and celebrating the good things. I think she has set up a culture where her players feel very comfortable going to her with quite literally anything, whether it's something on the court or off the court. I mean, I think at least in the Big Ten, I think she's a coach that has the best relationship with all of her players. And I think that makes it easier for them to want to play harder and not play for her, because of course they're playing for multiple reasons, but I think it's that relatability that has made her such a great coach and really, I mean, turned a program, I don't want to say around, because they've always been kind of historically good, but had the success that they've had in recent years because of that.
Mm-hmm. Katie Shoemaker-Cawley, Penn State has been, you know, one of 3 programs over the last 30 years that has been a dominant program. However, the team she inherited was not a dominant team. Most of them had left Penn State by the time she was named the head coach, and I think she's done a remarkable job creating a very competitive team. What does she do really well?
Well, I think number 1, I think she's a great recruiter. I mean, if you look at her team right now, 4 of the 6 pieces on her offense are all transfers, and she got really big names. She knew exactly what kind of fit and what kind of player she wanted for her program. I think the second part of it was what makes her great, even in this first year, is that I think she understands the Penn State legacy. You know, she coached under Russ Rose for so many years, played for him, was an assistant. Like, she understands the legacy of Russ in terms of his coaching styles and how to bring that into her own coaching. But then I think she's also adaptable. Like, she understands the way this game is going and, you know, kind of, I don't say like staying up to the times, but I think there are things that she does maybe differently than Russ Rose that I think potentially could benefit her down the line, just in terms of, you know, where the game is going and all of that. So yeah, I think she's a really good recruiter and I think she does a great job understanding Penn State, where they've come from and where she wants them to be.
Danny Busboom, Louisville.
Yeah.
You know, I watched them play Pitt this morning on a replay, and they got waxed the first two sets. They're out there. DeBeer's not playing for Louisville. But the thing that's most impressive about our culture is, and this is true with all great programs, doesn't have any impact about how they come out for the third set.
Yeah.
Yeah, she's pretty remarkable. What do you see in her?
Yeah, I agree. I think, well, she, of course, she comes from a background, I think, playing, coaching under Cook, that she understands also kind of what it's like to be at an elite program. So she gets what that is to kind of build that up. I think she's also a really great recruiter. She's done a fantastic job being in Louisville, obviously a major volleyball hub, getting so many local players and keeping them around, which I think is really important. It's, I think a lot of times what can make a program great is getting those, you know, local talent that want to play nearby. But I agree. I think she does a great job just firing her team up, and whether that's really nailing into them when they need it, or if that's letting up a little bit and letting her leaders kind of lead the way. I think she does a great job being adaptable to whatever team she has. If she feels like she has to be more of a harder coach on them, or coach them, you know, a little more difficult than maybe teams in the past that have been a little bit more player led. Like, for example, I think last season, you know, with players like Tori Dilfer and Anna Stevenson and the other great names that they had, I think it was a very big player led team. And I think they're, you know, really great this year too, but I think she has adapted in terms of they don't have the biggest names that have been there for so long that she has to kind of coach a little bit harder. And I think she does a great job being adaptable to whatever team that she has.
Right. Yeah. Talk a little bit more about Wednesday night's match. John Cook, Kelly Sheffield, they both lead in different ways.
Yeah.
They both have tremendous fan bases. The one thing that I would say, a risk that Nebraska has taken in moving to a facility that seats 8,500 people, you know, we're on a tipping point here. And my own opinion is that schools like Purdue, Louisville, schools that have operated in arenas of 2,500, 3,000 people have got to be willing to risk moving into larger arenas to continue to grow the sport. Overall, I think their recruiting will improve even more if they're able to do that. What do you think about that opinion?
I agree. I think it's nuanced in terms of, like, you take a place like Purdue. I mean, I personally think Holloway Gym is the hardest place to play in the country. It is, I think, by far the loudest, just because it is smaller, but because the students are as close as NCAA regulations allow. They can basically pull your hair. They're right there. It's nuanced because if you give up a smaller gym that's louder, you know, the question is, okay, well, will we fill an 8,000 person gym? Will it be as loud as it might have been playing in that smaller arena? So I agree. I personally think that coaches do need to take more risk. It's actually something I've talked to Kelly Sheffield about a lot. When talking about the Kohl Center match, where they broke the record, nearly 17,000 people attended for the NCAA regular season attendance record. He was saying, like, we might not be comfortable in a lot of these decisions, but we have to push the sport forward. And if that potentially means losing a match or something like that, for at the end of the day, it's good for the sport and we want to push this sport forward. So I agree. I think one, it helps recruiting a lot. If you're playing in these massive arenas, you know, it's, you're more well known, and, you know, I mean, you take Nebraska, that's a great example about it, from moving from the Coliseum to Devaney. And I don't know, in terms of difficulty to play, it's a hard question. Again, those smaller gyms can get really loud, but then those big gyms like Devaney are just intimidating walking in and, you know, seeing 8,500 faces looking at you.
Emily, Nebraska won 95% of its matches in the Coliseum historically. Yeah. It's not as hard to play in the Devaney Center, but when you have a larger arena that other people aren't doing, it also opens the door to recruits outside your own area.
Yeah.
So if you're recruiting a player from a smaller school in Nebraska and she would come into a 3,000 seat arena, she's going to think that's wonderful. But is somebody going to travel from Texas or from Hawaii or California or whatever? I don't think it's as likely. I think it's a step that we need to take. What do you see as are the critical issues on Wednesday night? Both these teams are running 6-2s.
Yeah.
I'm not a fan of the 6-2.
I'm not sure. You know what's funny is I don't think either coach is really a fan of it. I remember talking to both of them early on. They're like, this is kind of what we have right now. I think in terms for Nebraska, you know, both teams are benefiting from it in terms of blocking. Like their blocking numbers are so much better than they were last year. I think for Nebraska, Nicklin Hames is a phenomenal setter, obviously a four-time All-American, and I will say for a shorter blocker, she did a pretty good job up front over the last 4 years. But I mean, they're getting so much more production from a blocking standpoint and having the option to spread things out on any in-system or out-of-system play. You have that extra hitter up front and you have a hitter in the back row as well. So you essentially always have four options. And
I'm going to be a devil's advocate on this one.
Yeah.
Okay. Opponents are hitting 119. 119. Can't you give up a little bit on the block to set Lonstein more balls in the back row and you remove your weakest pin hitter? You follow what I'm saying? Right now, you're giving her sets to the weakest pin hitter. When I look at Wisconsin, he's got so many players. You know, he's got like five kids that could play middle blocker.
Yeah.
The kid that might play it the best isn't playing middle blocker. I mean, to me, Smrek would impact the match more in the middle than anywhere else. But he also has a wonderful player who came in from Wisconsin. He's got Hart, who's a wonderful player. He's got, I think Robinson has played middle some.
Yeah.
So to me, it looks like more of, man, I want to reward these kids.
Yeah.
But at some point, do either one of these teams evolve into a 5-1 at least situationally?
Yeah, I proposed that question to both teams in the past week or so, and I think they're both of the mindset of if it's not broke, don't fix it kind of thing. I mean, you look at Nebraska, they are leading the country by a very large margin in terms of opponent hitting percentage. So it's kind of like, why mess with it? Their offense is firing. They're doing really well. I agree. You could have Lonstein just hit a back row attack, and that's essentially having another option back there along with, you know, a six rotation outside with Kubik. And I don't know. I think we've been so wired to think who's the starting setter of any team. And I think this year specifically, we're just seeing teams asking and coaches asking themselves, okay, what system fits our team the best? You look at a team like Wisconsin, I mean, they just have so many great hitters that they kind of want to play to their strengths there. And in terms of blocking, it's the same thing. And in the case of Anna Smrek, I think she's definitely on the opposite pin because there's so many great outsides in the conference right now that she's, I mean, her touch percentage and her good touch percentage are just well above so many other opposite blockers that they kind of can't move her to middle because she's doing such a good job over there. And, you know, you have someone like Caroline Crawford, their other middle, who's doing a really great job, really holding her own on that front. But I agree. It makes sense of the, if it's not broke, don't fix it. But I don't know. I mean, it seems like it's sustainable. I think the big question coming into this year was like, are any of these 6-2 teams actually going to stick with it the whole year? And I think everybody, at least in conversations I've had, would have said, absolutely not. They'll probably switch for a Big Ten play or things start falling off the wagon. But like Nebraska is a team where they're trending upward. They're getting better and better. And I think it's because they're getting more comfortable in the 6-2. And again, I mean, you got all their hitters hitting above 300 for the most part, you know, 300 as a team off of both hitters. So I don't know, I guess if it's not broke, don't fix it, but it's working for whatever reason.
You have all the players hitting over 300 off both setters, but because you always have a setter in the back row, you have double the number of opportunities to have the libero bump set attackers.
Yeah.
That's the challenge. And when you look at the team that was number one for so long and maybe at the end of today, Texas, who throws the ball hard at the setters. Mm-hmm. The question is not if it ain't fixed or ain't broken, don't fix it, whatever. It's, are we preparing to beat Texas, to beat the team that may have the most talent in the country? But your answers are spot on. You know, I mean, I think you have really given a great insight into how coaches thinking. If one of them changed, it wouldn't surprise me if Kelly did. I think he's willing to, you know, I think if Wisconsin didn't evolve last season into back row attacks that they had in the national championship match, I don't think they'd win.
Yeah.
I think they took real risks there.
Yeah.
And when I look at Nebraska with Lahnstein, she's the one athlete you have that is the superior attacker. Mm-hmm. That when she's on, she's unstoppable.
Yeah.
So how am I going to get her more sets? That's why I'm living in a van down by the river.
No, I completely agree. And I mean, in going back to your point in the case of just getting the balls on setters, like every time I have a Wisconsin match or Nebraska match, the whole time I'm just thinking, why, like every hit, why isn't the other team just putting the ball on the setter? There's so many bailout situations where, you know, maybe it's not a hard hit, just get the ball in the setter and make them run an offense. Again, Lexi Rodriguez is an incredible out of system setter. So I think for Nebraska specifically, it really doesn't deteriorate their offense too much, but it's like every time just get the ball in the setter. Like I know that it's in their game plan, but these players, they got to think more about it during the games. Like just send it to zone one.
Emily, you're the best. And I'm going to look forward to watching you and Anne Marie on Wednesday night and watching the rest of the season. And volleyball is an exciting place right now, and you're one of the reasons it is. Thank you so much for being our guest.
Well, thank you so much. That means so much. I've learned so much from you, you know, over the past years. And of course, you're one of the best follows that I have on Twitter. So I absolutely love all your input there. But no, thank you. Thank you so much for having me. I mean, you laid the foundation work and we're just trying to continue it on.
All right. Have a great day.
You too.
Thanks for listening to Inside the Coaching Mind with Coach Terry Pettit. Tune in next time as we welcome in another guest to talk leadership, coaching, and team building. Inside the Coaching Mind is presented in collaboration with Learfield.